Assistance to Older Refugees. Ms. Baker.
Yes. Madam Chair, this is a federal grant application request for the department. We thought we would do it first on the agenda today to get you warmed up for some of your other activities and get it out of the way. And then the other two bills on your agenda, my understanding is Senate Bill 958A would be heard next, and then Senate Bill 329A would wrap up the balance of the day.
That's right. So let me ask Mr. Anderson, the manager of child care and refugee program, to come forward.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Anderson. I'm the coordinator for the state refugee program in Oregon. The refugee program, very briefly, the refugee program serves individuals who are fleeing persecution in their country of origin. And the funding comes from the Office of Refugee Resettlement. We contract with local partners, mainly in the Portland area, to deliver services to refugees who are arriving in Oregon. Currently, we have a couple of grants that do essentially the same thing as this grant would do. Services to older refugees. One grant focuses on linking elder refugees to mainstream services, and the other helps them with the citizenship process and naturalization process, which is a very complicated, time-consuming process. So this grant would essentially continue those services under one grant rather than two separate grants.
Questions? Mr. Fletcher?
Thank you for a motion.
Hopefully you guys sleep.
Madam Chair, I move approval of the Department of Human Services federal grant application request to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for services to older refugees.
Senator Gordley moves the Department of Human Services federal grant application request to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services services to older refugees. Are there any objections? Seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gibbon, changing of the guard. We will now have a public hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 958A. In the event Senator Johnson is hearing my voice, I thought she was going to be here.
Madam Chair, if I may.
You certainly.
I think Ms. Baker is going to go get her. She's in another subcommittee, and she'll be here in a moment. Dr. Higginson from the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services will testify on this bill as well.
Dr. Higginson, please come.
Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I am here today in support of Senate Bill 958A, which would provide more clarity and regulatory oversight for in-home care agencies. And I am sorry that Senator Johnson is not here yet, because she can explain the situation much better than I can. But last winter, the senator had a situation where she was trying to get care for a family member and engaged in the services of an... Since Senator Johnson is here, I will let her tell the story herself.
Okay. Thank you for joining us, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for your courtesy in allowing me to come and testify on this bill and, frankly, hearing it and working it. This bill is very close to my heart, and let me start by saying I think one of the great values of a citizen legislature is that we are able to bring forward from our own life experiences issues that we think affect public policy in general. And the legislature provides a forum to have the discussion about these issues. Excuse me. The genesis of this bill was the death of my mother this last January the 1st. She left St. Charles Hospital on the Friday before Christmas in the care of hospice. We were very concerned that she have appropriate and professional nursing care at home, knowing that the outcome of her situation was inevitable. We did the best we could to line up services by looking in the telephone book, having colleagues who were professionals in this field interact with the company that we had selected. We were basically promised the sun, the moon, and the stars. We had asked for CNAs at a minimum and RNs at a maximum. Money was not an issue as we were prepared to write a check. And the first night that the representatives from the company came, I was there alone. There is a reason that I am not in a caring profession. I'm trained as a lawyer, and I was admittedly deeply over my head with a dying mother and a paucity of skills to help me deal with the situation. That's why we reached out for professional assistance. When the doorbell rang, this very earnest young lady appeared at the door. When I showed her the list of hospice medications that my mother was taking, that included, as typically is the case with hospice, some narcotics, she announced that she was unable to even handle the medicines. I asked why, believing that the company had sent us a trained professional, and she announced that she was there as a companion caregiver. She wasn't able to handle any of the medications. It was my opinion at that point, at that very desperately sad and anxious night for me, that this is an industry that has great growth potential. As most of us in this room are part of the baby boomer generation, we are looking for care for our own loved ones, our parents, and thinking about the availability of in-home care for ourselves. It seemed to me that what the company had done bordered on fraud and negligence. And so I drafted this bill, had the opportunity to work with Dr. Higginson and others about the bill, and the sole purpose here is to bring a greater degree of regulatory oversight to what I think is a growth industry, so that when people do call and make contracts with companies for a certain level of care, that you would know that that level of care was going to walk in the door. You'd know that they had been background checked. You know that there had been some effort on the part of the company to assure appropriate performance. By no means do I wish to cast aspersions on those companies that perform well in this arena, because undoubtedly there are a lot of them. But the company that we contracted with in Central Oregon that very sad weekend didn't. And I think a greater level of oversight from the Department of Human Services would keep another family from falling into the situation that I found myself in 2 days before Christmas of this last year.
Thank you, Senator. Questions or comments for the Senator? Dr. Betts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for appearing before us, Senator. I know what you went through with your mother, and you have my deepest sympathy, and it was a hard time for you and a terrible time for your family. And in my particular area of the woods, we've got some great in-home services and have not had a great problem, but obviously that is not the case across the state, and easily could be that in our area be the same someday in the future without this type of oversight. As I look through the bill, I see licensing requirements. Is there something here that actually requires that the Department of Human Services or the Public Health Department is going to go out and look at programs on a regular basis, like we do nursing homes, like we do foster care homes, where someone actually goes and looks at a program and says, yes, it's doing a good job, or no, it's not doing a good job?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, if I might answer that question. Yes, if you look on the second page of the A. and Gross version, line 10, the department shall conduct an on-site inspection of each in-home care agency prior to services being rendered, and once every 3 years thereafter as a requirement for licensing. And that is a new part of the bill. That's a standard that we believe should be in place for all facilities and all agencies that we license and are happy to see it here. And that also will include in the funding package enough money to aggressively follow up on any complaints as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You answered my second question before I answered it. Thank you.
Further discussion? Just a quick question. Do you have some standards and protocol already in place?
Chair Carter and Senator, we do have some in place right now. As you can see, a number of new things have been added to the requirements, and so we will have to write some administrative rules to include those as well. But the biggest problem we've had so far is that we simply have not had the staffing to be able to do the inspections the way that we should have been doing, and the staffing that's provided within this bill is going to give us enough staff for us to be able to do that appropriately.
Senator Bates?
No, would you be willing to entertain a motion?
I am.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, just for a minute. Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about something that I'm looking at, trying to glance at the written testimony while I'm also listening to what we're hearing. In the letter that we have from Mr. Higginson delineating five deficiencies, there's something on page 2 that interests me that I wonder how this committee might deal with it if it's important to the other members of the committee. First paragraph on page 2, it says the vague definition of nursing services for in-home care agency remains, and so forth. The department hopes there will be legislative direction to address those issues over the interim. Is that something that this committee would discuss or some other group?
What was your intent in the writing of this piece, either of the two of you?
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, when we started working with Senator Johnson on this bill, there were a number of things that we were concerned about. Certainly all of the issues that she raised about in-home care agencies, but we also felt that there was some vagueness around the definitions of what they can provide in as opposed to what can be provided in home health agencies, which have much more stringent requirements about the supervisory responsibilities and about what services they actually provide. However, even when we were looking into home health agencies, there seemed to be some to us some places where things just were not addressed. The way the statute's currently written, home health is a intermittent service, so that if someone is getting 24/7 nursing care in their home, or even nursing care one shift a day routinely, that actually does not follow under our authority at this time. So I just think that there's some issues around making sure that all home health agencies are included in the statute, and trying to be clear about who should be providing what services and when needs some further work, and that's something that we'd be really interested in working on over the interim.
And Madam Chair, if I could respond, I see this very much as a work in progress. I would like this bill to go forward as sort of a clarion call to the industry that there is going to be a continuing legislative and agency oversight. I think that there may be other bills in future sessions. This would be sort of the doorway bill to say that this is an industry that has some problems. Because the night that very earnest young woman showed up, I hadn't retained somebody to water the plants and feed the cat while I was in Hawaii. I retained somebody who I expected to have the ability to care for a dying patient in extremis, to know about turning schedules, to know about medicine application protocols, to know about hygiene and demeanor in the house, to have the requisite nursing skills that no one in the house was possessed of. That's why we went to an agency. So I see this very much as a work in progress as this continues, I believe, to be a growth industry. All of us, I would submit, would like the peace of mind to die at home near your loved ones and to have a series of companies that are able to provide the level of care that is equal to the expectations, I think may take some time over a number of legislative sessions, but this would certainly be the first start to begin that definitional process and to work with the agency and to put the industry on notice that it matters to consumers, it matters to patients, it matters to patients' families, that the services that they provide are appropriate and professional and within the consumer expectations.
Representative, this is what usually takes place the leadership when some issues like this need to be dealt with during the interim. They assign it to a particular committee. Usually something like this would come to the Human Services Committee, so it's a leadership issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd certainly be pleased if we could continue to address this.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I just want to thank my senator for doing this. I wish we'd had this in place when my dad was dying because we didn't. We went the same things. We went for a week and a half trying to find someone to come into the home and care for him because his wife at the present couldn't do it and ended up putting him in an institution which he did not want, and I felt like I was betraying him, and I'm not sure he was very happy with that result, so thank you.
And Senator Carter, if I might add, the discussion we've been having, I mean, it makes it sound like there's that this is an industry break with problems, and there clearly have been some problems, as testified by Senator Johnson. But I do want to go on record as saying that at the committee hearing, we had members from the industry come up and tell us how important it was for them as well to have a bill like this, that they want to be seen as an industry that's providing high-quality services, and they welcome the kind of things that we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Are you ready for a motion, Madam Chair?
I am.
Thank you. I move Senate Bill 958 to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Wexler moves Senate Bill A. Engrossed 958 to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Seeing none, so
thank you for your courtesy, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Carry on the House, Representative Boone.
Madam Chair, would Senator Johnson like to carry it?
Senator Johnson, would you like to carry this bill?
I would. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. And Representative Garrard and the full committee.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That's what I've got.
Thank you very much.
Is that all right? Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Representative Garrard?
Senator Johnson may want to carry that to the full committee also.
Thank you. We'll do that. Thank you, Representative Garrard. Changing of the guard again. Who's
mine?
Welcome, Dallas. We will now close the hearing on Senate Bill 958 and open a committee hearing on Senate Bill 329A relating to the Oregon Health Fund Program. Senator Bates and Senator Westland. Yeah, while you're doing that.
All right.
While they're going down. Dallas, bring us up today.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, last week I handed out a memo summarizing. You have a-A15 amendment before you that was passed out, which is basically the bill. There were some modifications to the A-Engrossed prepared by the two sponsors, and a memo, I'll briefly say, from the A-Engrossed to the B-15, what the B-15 does, it just changes the name of the Oregon Health Trust Board to the Oregon Health Fund Board. It removes the requirement that the board establish a toll-free number for persons wanting information about access to public health services. It changes some exclusionary language on membership of the board. Previously, anyone who had received a majority of their income from the health care industry was precluded from sitting on the board. Now it changes it to if they received 50% or more of their family income during the prior 2 years, they cannot sit on the board. It leaves the board executive director a governor's appointment. It as opposed to being appointed by the board. Provides language throughout to support the bill to support and optimize federal fund match for program expenditures. Places the Office of Health Policy and Research, which is currently in the Department of Administrative Services, if we were to put that in the Department of Human Services until January of 2010, it places the Oregon Prescription Drug Program in the Department of Human Services permanently, and it provides, it has some blank language for appropriations, and I have at your desk, you should see the language that would replace the language that was drafted for the appropriation. We have approval for a certain amount of general fund and other fund, federal funds limitation from the co-chairs.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guard?
Is the A-15 already in?
Or
A-329?
No, you have, I handed it out last week. It was, it's a gotten stuff. What we did was we had the entire 329A modified for those changes that I had before you, or I mentioned.
Okay, so 15 is reflected in 329.
That is correct.
Okay.
The A-15 is the 329 in its entirety with a few changes.
But the A-16 is not a part of the bill as of yet.
That is correct.
Okay.
And the A-16 has been passed out to you. I believe there's someone here to testify, Ms. Representative Greenlick. We do not have co-chair's approval to put the for the A-16.
Gentlemen?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Alan Bates, State Senator from District 3, Medford and Ashland. And to my right.
For the record, Madam Chair, Committee, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, thank you for hearing this important bill. With that, to our right here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 329 is...
I'm not used to being on anybody's right. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm delighted to be the senior junior partner of these two gentlemen.
I hope you think it was the three amigos, not the three stooges we're going through here.
We're curly,
right? We're going to start off with a little video real quickly, and then we'll move into our discussion of the bill. Can we dim the light?
Yeah. We are approaching a healthcare crisis in Oregon and in this nation. There are more and more uninsured. In Oregon, even though the economy is improving, the number of uninsured is still rising. 613,000, more than one in six, do not have health insurance. Of those, 113,000 are children. Costs are increasing at unsustainable rates, not only for families, but also for businesses. In Oregon, in 2004, we spent $10 billion on health care alone. Most people get their insurance through work, but rising costs mean fewer employers can offer affordable plans. Over three-quarters of the uninsured come from working families. For businesses, annual increases in inflation and salaries are predictable, but increasing health care costs are skyrocketing and difficult to manage. This is keeping Oregon and America from being competitive in a global economy. Over half of health care spending in Oregon goes to hospital and physician expenses. There is a lack of coordination and accountability in today's healthcare system that drives costs up and doesn't provide incentives for wellness. The lack of primary care causes the overuse of expensive high-tech care. In a system where a doctor has an easier time getting reimbursed for an MRI than counseling a patient to stop smoking, it's no wonder a town the size of Bend has 9 MRI machines. We will always need high-tech care. But to improve our overall health, we need to emphasize preventative care. There are also other cost drivers, such as uncompensated care. But in a nutshell, our prison system doesn't really spend money to keep us from getting sick in the first place, and then spends too much to try and get us well. families that contribute to their own health insurance are seeing their costs skyrocket, over 73% since 2000. The U.S. spends double what other industrialized nations spend. Despite our high spending, health outcomes in the United States are among the worst in the industrialized world. Americans who reach age 60 are likely to die sooner in the U.S. than in most other industrialized countries. Last year, the Senate Commission on Healthcare Access and Affordability, comprised of legislators, healthcare advocates, business and labor representatives, and other stakeholders, met during the legislative interim and declared that incremental changes will not solve our state's healthcare crisis. Comprehensive reform is required. After hearing months of expert and public testimony, the Commission produced a framework to reform our healthcare system that is economically sustainable and can provide an essential benefits package for every Oregonian. The Senate Special Committee on Healthcare Reform is comprised of co-chairs Senators Bates and Westland, Vice Chair Senator Jackie Winters, and Senators Jeff Cruz, Laurie Monis Anderson, Bill Morissette, and Frank Morse. The House Healthcare Access Subcommittee is comprised of Chair Representative Mitch Greenwick, Vice Chairs Representatives Ben Cannon and Dennis Richardson, and Representatives Betty Comp and Karen Minnis. All are considering the Commission's plan, along with other healthcare proposals put forth by the Archimedes Movement, the Oregon Health Policy Commission, and the Small Business Council. The important thing is they all aim to make essential health coverage affordable and available to everyone. Learn more at hopeforhealthyoregon.com.
I'm going to go ahead and get started if we get that turned off. This is the first time that Ben and I have been able to do this with PowerPoint, so we're probably going to screw it up, okay? But we'll try not to. Ben's also going to help me out because I was up most of last night taking care of a very sick little boy down in Medford and just got up here this morning. So if my voice gives out, he's on for the rest of the show. I'd like to start out when we talk about health care reform and what we do in health care by telling the story of how Ben and I first met. I believe it was actually in this room, if I remember correctly. It was about three sessions ago, and I was sitting roughly where I sit now, and Ben was in the center here. Ben, at that time, was unknown to me. We just met. That was my first session up here. Ben had been up here before. And as we sat in committee there in January and February, and went on, I noticed he kept coughing and coughing and coughing and using an inhaler and coughing and coughing. And after several weeks of watching this, I went up and asked him about it. I felt a little uncomfortable because I didn't really know him. I'm a physician, but I didn't really know Ben. And I got to talking about his cough, and we decided to go ahead and get him worked up. We very quickly found out he unfortunately had lung cancer. Ben's never smoked, but he was exposed to secondhand smoke heavily as a child. He then went through two major chest surgeries, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, and now 5 years later, he's cancer-free. His last PET scan and CAT scans are all negative, so we know he survived, and he is a cancer survivor, and he'll have a long life in front of him. Some people say that I saved Ben's life, and some of those people have really never forgiven me. So we formed a bond, and he went through something that shows you what can happen in this high-tech industry we have that can save people's lives if you get the right treatment and you get it early and you get your diagnosis early. Ben's going to take the first part of this, and I'll step in later. Ben.
Thank you, Alan. I think that personal story, not just mine, but it reflects the stories of many Oregonians, certainly some in this room, that when we were able to have access to first-class medical attention, we are able to survive significant and traumatic illnesses based on our access to medical care. And so for me, this is not just, you know, some issue or a challenge. For me, and I know I speak for Alan and certainly for Mitch and certainly many in the room behind us, this is not just an issue. This is a calling. And that every Oregon citizen should have the same right and the same access to the medical care that was able to save my life. I don't want to belabor this too much, but just to recap a little bit of the slide presentation which we gave all over the state, or that little DVD. You know, in this country, we spend double what any other industrialized country in the world spends on health care. And by any indice you want to use, World Health, National Institute of Health, our outcomes are just, let's face it, lousy. And you draw this scenario up, we're spending more money producing worse outcomes in a country that unquestionably has the best doctors, best hospitals, and best access to medical technology in the world. Something is desperately wrong. And what's worse is just that. It's getting worse. Healthcare costs are up 73% since 2000 alone, with no end in sight. And most significantly, certainly a representation of this, we are currently in the 55th month of a very robust economic expansion, and not one net life has been added to Oregon's insured rolls. Not one. Not through private enterprise or through the state. We have not been able to insure one additional life of the 145,000 we were forced to uninsure during this last recession. It's not because the state isn't compassionate. It's not because these businesses, are bad corporate citizens. Far from it. These were the good guys. These were the guys that had insurance previous. It's because they simply can't afford it. You all know what we've all been going through in trying to add additional lives to the Oregon Health Plan. Just to get back what we had with the Standard Plus population, it's $500 million. We as a state and our businesses are increasingly unable to afford paying for health care in its current system. And as I said earlier, what's worse, it will only get worse. Most assuredly, without question, get worse, unless we as public policymakers are proactive in solving this problem. That's why we bring you Senate Bill 329 today with such enthusiasm and optimism. So with that, Madam Chair, what I'd like to start through is go through the slide committee. Alan and I are going to tag team on this a little bit. I will tell you, I hand this laser pointer to him with some trepidation.
Get it back.
He considers it a toy. I think it only is a work instrument. The first thing we have is, first slide here is the four individual, and it is not without significance that four very good plans brought forth independently and forthrightly came to this legislative session. What that indicates is the depth of the crisis that shows just how serious this crisis of enormous economic and ethical proportions truly is. So all four of these plans came forward. They all have strengths, weaknesses, things we like, things we don't like. But next slide, please. So what our committee, the Senate Special Committee on Healthcare Reform, was tasked to do was to glean the best and most practical applications that we could from all of these proposals. At this juncture, I want to compliment Chair Greenlich and every one of his committee members because, and you all know this, how difficult it is, evening committees, 2 days a week, for month after month after month, we all met in Hearing Room 50 and went through these various proposals, and Mitch
thank you so very much for getting all your committee there every time. I think you had better public attendance than you did, but as Senate members. But it was truly a joint House-Senate collaborative that went through all of these bills, you know, to pick what we felt was the best from all of them. Certainly, every one of these proposals, the Senate Commission plan, the Archimedes movement, the Health Policy Commission, Oregon Business Council proposals, all had things included, all had things left on the cutting room floor.
So, do you mind just answering one question for me? Now, do you plan to go section by section?
Just real quickly, and I'm starting to pop on this thing.
All right.
I think she was saying hurry up. Okay.
I'm just asking your plan.
We're
not going 6 months.
So anyway, so we combined much of these bills into what we had before.
So let me interrupt you one more time. The House convenes at 2 o'clock.
Madam Chair, the next slide. representation of all the various cities that we went to, 24 town halls. We included 22 legislators and saw over 1,200 individuals all around Oregon to put this together. All four of the proposals had the same goals, which is in a very short summary, and this is very important. You know, if we can't lower costs, provide access to everyone, and improve quality, we've got nothing. That's what this is all about. Lowering costs, increasing quality, and providing 100% access. The next slide shows in a graphic presentation what 329 really does. We have the Oregon Health Fund Board. It's appointed by the governor. The governor appoints an executive director. And then, quite uniquely, I think, the Oregon Health Fund Board executive director meshes with an existing state capacity in the Office of Health Policy and Research. And under those, we create five separate subcommittees, again, utilizing the expertise, data, and experience that we already have within state coffers. The Oregon Health Fund Board is a board, seven-member citizen board appointed by the governor. They will be appointed immediately and try to get to work as quickly as possible. They will be confirmed by the Senate in September. This says October. I have no idea why. They are the entity responsible for crafting the blueprint, the roadmap, for a comprehensive plan to be presented to the Oregon legislature in the 09 session. Just quickly, the executive director is appointed by the governor. He coordinates the work between the board and the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. Oregon Health Policy and Research, which we are moving from DAS, also along with the prescription drug pooling plan, over to DHS. There we'll just utilize these existing state resources, and they'll coordinate the work of all the subcommittees. The five subcommittees are very important. The first is finance and cost containment. How do we pay for this, and how do we contain cost? That's simple. The benefits board is we utilize Oregon Health Services Commission. They've done exemplary work, probably the best in the country at establishing benefits. They're the folks that came up with Oregon's famous prioritize list. So we utilize that existing services. Why don't you take it from there?
I'm going to go very quick. We've got 15 minutes left, I understand, and so I'm going to give you a quick overview. We're not going to go section by section. We're going to give you an idea of what this bill does and then get you out of here. You've got to be on the floor at 2 o'clock, correct? find some cost containment. I think you just have to keep up with me, Mike, as best you can. We'll make recommendations about shared responsibility, but that we need examples of what Fred Meyer has in the self-insured program. If you want to go get off cigarettes, they'll only let you go off work. They'll only pay for the cigarette cessation program. They'll actually pay you to go to the program. They brought costs down by doing that. Their average increase in premium is 5% when everybody else is 15%. We're going to implement a health insurance exchange so small business individuals can buy into group rates through the exchange. Take advantage of HSAs and other savings accounts that we've known to make individuals responsible and help bring costs down. We're going to address medical liability. We're not going to go into that right now, but there's ways of bringing that under control. The real cost of medical liability is not really medical liability. That's 0.8% of the cost of health care. 10-12% of the cost of health care is defensive medicine. That's what we've got to get to. People doing things they don't need to do, simply to cover themselves. And we're going to identify some barriers to providing cost effectiveness. This is making sure that insurers pay for things like routine exams and that people get in for that preventative primary care they need so badly. Next slide. The Oregon Health Fund Board will set up the benefits program. The benefits program was run by the Health Services Commission. That's what I served on for over 10 years and chaired for almost 4 years. These people have expertise along with people coming from the industry to help us understand what the best benefit plan would be for this group or for other groups. They have a benefit plan right now for Medicaid called the Prioritized List. I don't expect that to be what the benefit for this will be, but we have the expertise to bring that forward. Next slide. Eligibility and enrollment. We'll have public subsidies so that people who are in low-income situations through FEOP or similar programs can buy into health insurance. We want to standardize enrollment application process and billing process. One of the good examples I always use is I had the advantage of seeing my doctor not too long ago, about 3 months ago, 4 months ago now. I got a bill. I couldn't read it. I got another bill a month later. Couldn't read it. Third month, I got a bill that I could read. Stamp on said you're being sent to collections for $3.12. Now I got an action out of me. But it looked like a monkey doing a math problem, and I'm a doctor. You can't read these things. We want to make these things simpler to read. You've all gotten bills from your doctor. You wonder, what the heck is this all about? Well, our residency requirements and waiting periods, obviously, if you open up this program, one of the keys of this program is having everybody in Oregon insured. If we've got that program in Oregon, we simply can't let everybody in because we'll be swamped with people coming with pre-existing conditions. So there's language in the bill to deal with that. The delivery system, Mike. Ensure that the viability of existing Medicaid programs. We don't want to touch our great FCHIP programs. We don't want to lose our safety net clinics. We don't want to lose the things we've got in place. We're going to build on those building blocks we already have. We have incentives for personal responsibility. We'll talk about some of the time. We've got time right now. And we'll put up partnerships to define the benefits as we already mentioned. We have some federal laws we have to take care of. And Ben, you're going to take off from there again. I went faster than you did.
I've got an A on this slide. Anyway, one thing we're very appreciative of, and I want to speak from the heart with regard to the Archimedes movement and John Kitzhaber's contribution to this. Our former governor and certainly the individuals from all around the state that comprise the Archimedes movement had a substantial impact on Senate Bill 329. We, quite frankly, when we began in the interim commission report, did not have a federal subcommittee. And in the creation, the construct we put together, a very specific committee is singularly tasked with looking at Medicaid eligibility requirements and household income levels. I mean, we certainly want to apply for Medicaid waivers. Certainly federal policies regarding portability and self-insurance and Medicare reimbursement rates in Oregon. And all of this is designed to come up with recommendations to our congressional delegation to request that they introduce legislation at the federal level to remove some of the impediments that Oregon endures to provide, again, lower cost, improved quality, and 100% access to all Oregonians.
Sorry, just a moment. House members, if you have questions, please feel free to ask those questions.
Madam Chair, I sense that the good senator mentioned the Archimedes movement, which is Senate Bill 27, and there are a number of us who were signed on to that particular measure. Is that particular measure going to move, or what's the future of Senate Bill 27? Or do you know?
Well, you're going to have to talk to someone at a higher pay grade than us to answer that question. But, like I say, we are very pleased and grateful for the influence and improvement that the Archimedes movement has made to this bill. I mean, that's pretty much it in terms of the federal law changes. We just get back to a graphic again that just illustrates what we went through quite quickly. Timeline for all of this is very clear within the bill. I don't want to burden us with going through this, but it's a standard timeline. One critical difference, and if you could flip to the next page, Mike, is that by October 1, the comprehensive plan worked up by the subcommittees with input through all of the subcommittees and their members, which will include providers and citizens and patients and advocates. That's due October 1st to the overall board. At which time they are statutorily enabled under this legislation to introduce legislation. It doesn't go to the governor's desk, or it doesn't go to president or speaker's desk. They are statutorily required to present legislatively for all of our consideration the proposal of the plan. With that, Madam Chair, I'll hand it over to Alan, and maybe we can.
I'll try to bring this home very quickly here. I'm going to go very quickly over a very complex topic with the benefits of reform. I'll give you a couple of quick examples as I go through this.
Senator, I was just in case we want to try to get this bill worked today. That's the only reason I was rushing you, but we can bring this back tomorrow.
You actually may need to.
I am very comfortable with that.
Yes.
Because I know we have people in the audience.
Just in case the House members would have questions and want to listen as well.
Yeah, we'll go as quickly as we can, but thank you for that time tomorrow.
Sure.
The real thing we've got to do here, besides getting everybody insured, as Ben has said, is bring down costs. We have to do that by changing how we actually take part in health care. What I think is the most important is preventive and the Centers for Wellness. I want to give you an example of what can go wrong, what can go right in the system. We have a case right now in Medford, Oregon, of a woman who's about 45 years old who didn't have any health insurance, worked two jobs, put off seeing a doctor for 4 or 5 years. And then when she finally started having a lot of abdominal pain, went to the emergency room, as people do when they don't have insurance. They quickly found out she unfortunately had cervical cancer that had gone into her abdomen, metastasized to her abdomen. This lady is now going to face chemotherapy, probably two surgical procedures, possibly radiation therapy. It's going to be very painful and difficult for her. She'll obviously be facing bankruptcy when she's through. That's if she even survives, and she'll go through a lot of pain and suffering before she gets there. And she may not live. If she'd had good preventative care, her condition would have been found out very early, very minimal cost, and would take care of the office, and she would have had a long and healthy life as a result of that. However, our system will take care of her. It'll be the end of the disease process, and I expect that expense will be somewhere between $200,000 and $400,000 for something we could have taken care of for a few thousand dollars if in a physician's office. And that, in many ways, is exactly what's wrong with our healthcare system. We spend too much money, too much time and effort on end of disease, not end of life, but end of disease, and nothing up front. We don't get people's blood pressure down. We don't control the cholesterol. We don't take care of the blood sugars or diabetic. They don't get the care they need, and it balloons up this cost hugely and gives us poor results. This particular plan we're looking at will give consumers their own choice. Providers get to pick your own doctor. It's portable. If you change jobs, it goes with you. If you're already an Oregonian, your pre-existing conditions are covered. We see a shared risk through increased pooling. That's what that fund is all about, bringing Medicaid funds and employer-employee dollars together through the pooling. We should expect significant administrative streamlining. This is not to put more people in a situation where we have more administration. One of the jobs of that board is to cut through some of that red tape and get rid of it for us. We need fair and fast reimbursements, and ones that we all understand and can see and understand. We need to be able to site facilities where they're really needed, not where people are fighting for market share. In my community this morning, we just opened up our second cardiovascular unit, in other words, bypasses. We have two bypass centers now about 10 minutes apart in a city of about 250,000. We don't need to, but they have to fight for share, and some things are highly reimbursed, other things are not. So the hospital had to add this in, had to do so to survive. That kind of stuff has to be fixed and changed, and I don't believe you can do it without an overall board that can help you make those decisions. We want to put together what's called an advanced directory. Right now, if I want to find out if a child's had all their immunizations, I can go to a computer model in this state, pull that child's name up, it's covered in a way that they don't lose any privacy, and I can find out what immunization that child needs. If someone comes to my emergency room, as happened to me a couple of months ago, in a comatose or near comatose state, I have no idea what they want. We have pioneered in this state something called a pulse form. And that form is a big pink form that tells us what you want us to do at the end of your life if you can't tell us yourself. It doesn't do me any good when it's stuck on a refrigerator at home or in somebody's bathroom or wherever. What we find often is I bring someone in, they can't speak for themselves, I take them to the intensive care unit, I spend 3 or 4 days with them there doing a lot of things to them they may not want done, and then the pulse form shows up and says they didn't want anything done. I've kind of tortured them for 3 or 4 days, and now I've got to start turning machines off. We need that registry up front so we can know what that patient wants. Mental health and drug and alcohol services have to be a big part of this. Without them, you'll find your system just overloaded with these other problems and the comorbidities. We want a good electronic medical record that can talk to each other. We want to focus on proven treatments. By that I mean this. If you have prostate cancer in Bend or prostate cancer in Salem or Portland, right now the likelihood of getting an operation is twice as high as it is in Bend than in other parts of the state. And the reason for those, and not only to pick on Bend, you can take tonsillectomies, you can take all kinds of procedures we do, and it varies across the state based on what the training of the individual physicians are and what their usual practices in that area is. It's not based on outcome. Based medicine. It's not based on that. We need to change those things. There are a lot of people here I know that want to speak today, Madam Chair, and so we've rushed kind of through this. I want to represent Greenlick to have a good opportunity to speak to his bill also, which may be amended into this bill. We need to have that discussion now, if you like, sir.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you. Again, for the record, I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick. It shows you the trouble I've had getting airtime. Thanks to the guys. I'm very happy to support Senate Bill 329. We've worked hard through the summer and through this session to craft this. I think it has the potential for moving us towards health care reform. That's really important. We all have our personal stories about this. So I think, you know, I was diagnosed during the last session of the legislature with lymphoma, earned $100,000 or so worth of medical care, had eye surgery in September, then had an accident, and I was laying on the street waiting for the ambulance to come and thinking about, what if I didn't have health insurance? What would be happening? What would I tell the ambulance driver, and how would I be affected? And again, I ended up in the hospital with double knee surgery and bringing another $100,000 or so. I've had health insurance all my life, so I've been paying for this up front. But if you don't have health insurance, it really changes your life. And we need to be moving towards universal access, and this bill does it. I also want to speak for a moment to the Dash 16 amendments, the extent to which we can get the co-chairs to agree to consider adding the Dash 16 amendments. What 329 does, and it's a very important thing, is it sets us on a pathway to health care reform, and it gets us thinking about how to get universal access. But what it doesn't do is provide a single bit of medical care in the interim. The Dash 16 amendments is an amendment form of House Bill 3097 that we worked with all the advocates who wanted to change the healthcare system to create an omnibus bill to start some demonstrations that will guide the way as we move to universal access to providing changes in the healthcare system. I mentioned when we were working, we had a work group of about 20 people. I said, I'm a Kaiser member. When I get sick or I get hurt, I know where to go. But if you don't have health insurance, you don't know where to go. And the quick answer from the group was, oh, yes, you do. You follow that blue sign with an H on it and end up in the emergency room. And that is what happens to people. And it's not a very effective or a very efficient way, as Senator Bates just pointed out with his case. We really need to find a way to get everybody into primary care. And these Dash 16 amendments provide an opportunity to do that, even at the moment if there isn't any money attached to it. So I would, if we wait till tomorrow, we'll have more time to talk to the co-chairs, and I hope we can find a way to get the Dash 16 amendments into 329, because it really makes sense to have them together, to have one thing, a plan for moving toward universal access, and the other piece of it, a set of demonstration projects around the state.
Quick question, because the representative mentioned getting everyone into primary care and Medicaid currently. What percentage are we in primary care now versus fee-for-service?
Under Medicaid?
Mm-hmm.
Under Medicaid, at least there's a fighting chance to get people into primary care, although I think less than two-thirds of the people have regular primary care in who are in the Oregon Health Plan, although at least there's the opportunity to do it. If you don't have health insurance, there's virtually no opportunity to get into regular primary care. So what we're talking about in the demonstrations in the Dash 16 amendments, each of these demonstrations, one of the requirements is that they accept people into primary care who don't have health insurance.
Do we have the workforce capacity? I mean, we're talking primary care, we're looking at doctors and nurses, and I know we have struggled with not having both in the nursing and physicians enough in the pipeline, so I'm wondering how that fits with, I think it's laudable. I agree with you that we need access to primary care as well as we move towards increasing the access to managed care. So how does that fit in all of this?
The Dash 16 amendments are aimed right at that problem. They were put forward by the Oregon Primary Care Association, by the Safety Net Clinics, by the 100% Access in the Community projects. And what they're trying to do is to show experimental ways to deal with the question of getting people into access to primary care. We do know as people get older, we're going to have an enormous physician and nurse and other medical manpower problem. But these demonstrations are an attempt to find more efficient ways to deal with that. Is that a question? It's okay.
What are the, this is a different question, what are the objections, or what is your understanding of the objections to the Dash 16 amendments?
I'm not sure I understand exactly what the objections are, but what I've heard from the co-chairs, at least my half, is 329 is meeting clean, and we're not sure they ought to have amendments on, but I don't know beyond that.
To follow up, Senators Bates and Westland, your comments on the Dash 16s?
Madam Chair, I agree with the comments by the representative. Probably the biggest problem here is a matter of funding. 329 is a process. It's a process to get us to full and complete insurance for every person in Oregon. The Dash 16 amendments are pilot projects that would show us how to be more efficient delivering health care, especially primary care. The big problem is the cost of those projects. Right now, I think that we're looking at a bill that potentially would say until such time as it's funded, depending what would happen to the tobacco tax and the sources of revenue. I don't believe there's revenue in this budget at the present time for that project.
Okay. This leads me to my other question about Senate Bill 27 and where it fits in the conversation, where and how it fits in the conversation.
329, 27, and certainly 3097. There is nothing exclusive or contradictory between any of those bills. And if I could also answer maybe just a little bit your prior question, Senator Gordley, with regard to decisions about 3097. I think Senator Bates hit it right on the head. I think the biggest issue here is funding. When we get to this time of session, priorities compete with ever scarcer dollars. So I see that as the primary impediment. Again, as I was alluding to with your earlier question, 27329 or 5097 are all perfectly capable of standing alone on their own 2 feet. So it's like say those are decisions that will be made at a pay grade above ours.
I can appreciate what you're saying to a point, and this is not to put anyone on the spot, but it is about trying to bring forward as much transparency as possible at this pay grade in terms of intent. You know, the intent. Where do you see the nexus? Where is the intersection? At the end of the day, on sine die, what would you like to see in place? Would it be all three of these pieces? One of these pieces? That's what I'm trying to get at. While we have the three of you sitting here.
I think all of us have worked long, hard, forthrightly, and very sincerely to bring forth what we all think has merits to the best merits to our approach in solving what is, I think, unquestionably the crisis in healthcare. I have focused on 329, I know, along with Senator Bates and Senator Greenlee. That is the solution that we have proffered. That is the one we are here to advocate for today. This is what we have spent 2 years working on. But again, these are not mutually exclusive bills in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
Senator Morissette?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair. My involvement with this committee has been interesting. I did attend the evening meetings throughout the year, and I did advocate for what is going on at the ground. All health care delivery is local. I wanted to take a look at the local delivery systems, and I think Representative Greenlee did that. These are not mutually exclusive. They do fit together very well. One of them is a pilot project, so to speak, around the state. 100% access in Lane County has been extremely successful. And my feeling is, you know, a plan has to be built from the ground up. Now, I see these plans meshing beautifully, and I hope that they can move along together. I'm not sure what the fiscal is going to be on the primary care home collaborative demonstration program. There are 10 pilots around the state. I think they're essential. It's going to be interesting to see how they do mesh. I would also like to see Senate Bill 27 move. I'm signed on to that. I know there are about a couple hundred thousand people around the state signed on to that, near 100,000. But as far as this plan that we have before us today with the -16s, I think the -16s are extremely important to the success of any overhaul of the health program. Thank you.
Any discussion?
I'd very much like to see 329 with the -16s attached and about $10 million to go along with it. Because I think it has the potential to change the healthcare system for the future in ways that are really important. I think 329 with dash 16s without that much money as well, because I think that would be useful. The importance of Senate Bill 27, and I don't think that can be minimized, is that if we're really going to straighten out this problem of universal access and organization healthcare system, it's going to happen at the national level. We're going to work like hell at the state, and we're going to be pioneers. But the real question of universal access has to happen at the national level. At least the main piece of Senate Bill 27, the request for waivers, is intended to start that discussion in a significant way. And I urge Governor Hitzhaber to separate the waiver request from the burden of the planning infrastructure that goes with it. Although I'm signed on to 27 and I'm willing to support it, and it seems to me the request for waivers really has the potential to start the discussion at the national level, and that's where that discussion has to be. So I think I still favor the piece of 27 that will push that national debate.
Thank you very much, and we open up the public hearing piece of this.
Thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Doug Wiggs, Betty Johnson, Mike, I think, Fred Huntington. Mike Huntington. Important that we might see everybody. I'd like to give you three minutes each. You will stop making that 3 minutes speech.
Chairman Carter and members of the Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform for Ways and Means. I'm Michael Huntington, retired physician, representing Physician Advocates for Sensible Healthcare in Oregon and the nation. And I'm especially appreciative of the passion and work that Senator Bates and Weston have put in, and Representative Green have put into this effort. And thank you for holding this hearing.
I don't
want to see. As a radiation oncologist in Corvallis, I've seen the tragic end results of people not having timely access to health care with advanced cancer and appearing in the emergency room with untreatable illness. You are considering two bills, at least there's two that we're talking about today, that can greatly decrease the incidence of this neglected illness and the suffering. Both bills involve prioritization of services and based on research and best evidence. Senate Bill 2329, as I understand it, still lacks the critical step of including Medicare in consideration. Why must we include Medicare? Well, it's a dominant part of a healthcare system that is bankrupting our state and our nation with self-defeating incentives. Senator Bates and Weston mentioned these problems. Our group and 7,000 members of our committee's movement urge you to include Medicare at least in the public forum that must accompany true health care reform. We know that AARP opposes the inclusion of Medicare in any state legislation. It instead proposes partial solutions or non-solutions with its divided we fail program. It keeps seniors safe in the upstream end of the canoe, but does not bring the canoe to the safely to shore before the waterfall. I spoke with one of the AARP representatives who said states should do this, or Washington, D.C. should make this change, not states. But we all know that gridlock prevents action in Washington, D.C. Oregon is far ahead of Washington, D.C. in advancing renewable energy, for example, and emission controls. There are other aspects of 329 that probably should be improved, including building the infrastructure, and I haven't seen the Dash 16 modifications. It still is a patchwork. We're relying heavily on private insurance and medical savings accounts, which are basically unfair to poor people. They don't have the money to invest, and they get fewer tax breaks from having investment. It still is a multiple payer system, which allows cost shifting. There's unclear participation of public in this. There are waiting periods, and I don't know if we've gotten rid of the pre-existing conditions clause also. It also allows underwriting and therefore risk selection. In summary, I think we need both Senate Bills 329 and 27, or at least a merger that will answer these questions that I've raised for you. Thank you.
Senator Carter, members of the Ways and Means Human Services Committee, I thank you for this opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 329, and I also want to express my appreciation for your extremely challenging work. I don't envy you, you know, the position you're in and the challenges that you're faced with in this important legislative committee.
Would you identify yourself for us, please?
Yes. I'm Betty Johnson, and I identify myself as a healthcare advocate who cares deeply about the need for affordable and quality healthcare for all Oregonians. This goes way back to the time when I was chair of the healthcare committee for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. So I've been at this for the past 20 years in involved in a variety of ways, educational activities and advocacy activities, always with the goal of trying to significantly improve the healthcare access, quality, and affordability. I support Senate Bill 329, particularly because the bill allows the pooling of health care dollars under the health fund, and also because of the renewed focus on preventive and primary care, which will certainly contribute to controlling health care costs. The authors of Senate Bill 329, some of whom are here, certainly demonstrated their knowledge of the complexity of the problems of the current healthcare system when they recognize the need for comprehensive reform and for examining the ways that federal policies impact our efforts to control costs, improve quality, and develop a sustainable health care system for all Oregonians. I support Healthy Kids, Senate Bill 329, and Senate Bill 27 as a package, and I urge you to support this critically important team effort. As you know, Healthy Kids addresses the immediate crisis of all the uninsured children, many of them, I should say, and Oregonians who were got from the Oregon Health Plan coverage. Senate Bill 329 addresses the crisis of the uninsured, and 27 begins a process to achieve comprehensive reform of the health care system. 27 can build on Healthy Kids and 329 by giving Oregonians the opportunity to have a thoughtful conversation about the role and the impact of federal policies, including Medicare. Medicare is a major component of the healthcare system, and I know you're very well aware of that. Leading out of the discussion, Medicare is a part of comprehensive reform efforts would really be a significant omission. My personal conviction is that in a democratic society, it's very important that citizens really join in the conversation and propose solutions to major issues like this that affect every aspect of our lives. That's what Senate Bill 27 will do for us. It will provide Oregonians the opportunity to participate.
Ms. Johnson, can I ask you to wrap it up, please?
Excuse me?
Can I ask you to wrap it up, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
So I don't want us to wait for Congress to act. I want us, you know, in this state to do what we've done many other times as Oregonians and move forward to come up with creative solutions. And I urge you to support 329, Healthy Kids, and Senate Bill 27.
Thank you. Mr. Reed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Primary Care Association. I've met with you many times this year, and we really appreciate the leadership that you've shown in bringing this bill forward. Our clinics serve over 250,000 Oregonians, and I want to make one very important point, which is something that I've noticed as I've been into those clinics, many of which are in your districts. If you'd gone to our clinics 3, 4, or 5 years ago and you asked the clinic director what percentage of our patients were uninsured, you would have come back with a number of 15% or 20% or 25%. We may have made up the difference with fundraising, federal support, et cetera. Then along came 2003, 80,000 people were cut off their Oregon health plan, healthcare costs skyrocketed, companies cut health insurance coverage, and so if you went back and asked those very same directors, many of whom are still there, what is their uninsured population, what you would hear is 47%, 51%,
75%, as high as 90% uninsured in our clinics. So this issue today is very important to every one of those people, those quarter million people who are in these systems. I have a letter which I won't read from the Oregon Primary Care Association. Suffice to say that we're very much appreciative of the bill, fully supportive of Senate Bill 329, and we think we absolutely need to move forward with this immediately. I'd like to get something passed and reformed tomorrow. I think this process will get us down the road. By itself, 329 is a terrific bill. It's not quite the entire solution, which is why Representative Greenlake, Representative Maurer, Representative Richardson, and a group of us met to say, what can we do right now to avert people from those emergency rooms, which is the universal access point for healthcare right now. And it's the place at which costs are 8 or 10 or 12 times higher than they need to be. And I would argue, if you keep in mind, that we are spending many orders of magnitude more than $10 million in a biennium on ER care and higher healthcare costs. So when we're talking about avoiding a seemingly large cost of $10 million to have 10 new access points around the state providing access to low-income Oregonians, I would say that's saving. That's a cost savings. It also allows us to match with federal dollars the investment the state's making. We also believe strongly that we'll have private donations as well. So if we think that immediately, within the next few months, we could come back and give you a progress report on the types, the number of people we expect to be able to be seen in these primary care homes or collaboratives instead of in the ER, the kind of savings we're looking at, and you could get some very good hard data that would aid the Senate Bill 329 process. So in summary, we're 100% behind Senate Bill 329. Thank the authors. We thank the committee for holding hearing today. Our members, thank you. And anything we can do to help, we're here to help. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank
Madam
you.
Chair.
Dr.
Huntington, if I could, Madam Chair. Good to see you, Mike. There was a discussion last week or two about Senate Bill 27. Mm-hmm. I know that's what's a major concern for a lot of people in the room right now. 27, the biggest difference from some of the other bills we're looking at is really talking about, obviously, Medicare, improving the benefits, bringing costs down, and making Oregon not the last state in the union being paid, but one of the better states paid, at least getting up to the average even. Right now, people with Medicare may not be able to find a primary or other physician to treat them in this state. Mm-hmm. Half the people in Portland are already having trouble, and people in eastern Oregon are starting to have trouble also. If 27 was amended to attack the problem of benefits, problems of cost, but not force a direction that Medicare costs or Medicare dollars have to go into a pool, would you still be supportive of that if it was still getting to the root problem of Medicare but not forcing the issue by putting money into a major pool?
I think so. We certainly want the discussion to go ahead because we can't ignore the tremendous cost of Medicare, as you're aware, in your practice. And the sooner we get started on that debate and involve the public and have a transparent process, the better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Huntington. We're looking at potential design benefit clause for 27, so thank you.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. To what extent do your clinics deal with the mental health community?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Senator Morissette, all of our clinics are required by federal law to address primary care treatment, dental treatment, and mental treatment, mental health care treatment. And so we either have mental health within our clinic or we contract with a local organization to do so.
Follow up, please. If we put $10 million into your program, how would that enhance the mental health aspect of it?
I'm Chair Senator Morissette. We think that would be a tremendous benefit of the primary care home model is trying to integrate a comprehensive, holistic approach that's appropriate culturally and from a community standpoint to address the entire health care of an individual. And in many cases, what we have now is a bifurcated or trifurcated healthcare system where someone goes one place for one kind of healthcare and then has to be shipped across town to do some other healthcare. The idea of a primary care home, especially for our populations, is to try to coordinate that all under one roof. And for many of our patients, mental health treatment is very important and helps them to the point where they can continue with their medications or their health regimens, understand what they're being asked to do. And so mental health treatment is part and parcel of one of the most important things that our clinics work on.
Madam Chair.
Senator Porter?
Thank you. Mr. Riggs, what concerns do you have about the composition of the Oregon Health Trust Board and its subcommittees as it is laid out in the bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, we are very pleased with the outcome of the various amendments that were adopted in the process. We participated in all the interim hearings. We attended all the hearings here in hearing 50, many of which ran late into the night. And we felt that the authors of the bill always had an open door. We took a number of suggestions and amendments to them. If you look at Senate Bill 329, you'll see sprinkled throughout there elements of the primary care home, safety net clinics, vulnerable populations, language that we suggested. And so we really think that the composition of the board and the subcommittees are going to be very important and appropriately designed. And the governor obviously will pick who is on the board. But we're confident that it will be a good process and the right people will be representing that process.
Okay.
Question. What is the federal match, Mr. Riggs?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, that's a very good question and something that
I'm always thinking of money.
Yeah. that's something that our work group discussed quite a bit. And one of the things you'll notice in the Dash 16s, as you'll notice in House Bill 3097, is it's designed to be flexible as far as seeking creative proposals that are tailored to the local community needs. So in some cases, increasing access might include increasing the number of people who might be eligible for the Medicaid match. In other cases, it might be trying to take advantage of the federal matching funds that are available under the Deficit Reduction Act for health care delivery pilot projects. And there may be other realms as well. But I would say that that is something that we direct the DHS to take a very close look at and to consider in awarding the grants, because the goal is to take the state money and leverage federal dollars, leverage other local funds, and be able to come back with some real results.
Madam Chair, had you thought in terms of, I know we did the Oregon's Children's Plan, and we did like family building blocks and some of those programs. One of the requirements was that we had X amount of dollars coming from the local community, which then also went to match with state dollars, and then you could take and leverage federal. Has any thoughts been given to that kind of a formula?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, yeah, actually we spent quite a bit of time in the committee talking about just that issue. We initially had conversations of a 2-to-1 match or a 1-to-2 match or, 50-50. In the end, the reason we decided, and others may be able to speak this more accurately than I was, but I think the reason we decided not to put a specific number in the bill is partially our concern about rural communities, which may have a difficulty meeting a certain match requirement, or the possibility of calculating, how do you calculate a voluntary match, number of hours or people voluntary in the community. But in the amendments, I think you'll see a strong indication that we want the DHS to put an emphasis on matching funds, federal, local, time, facilities, etc. Those are all very important. And if you look at the Evolve Pact program in Medford, if you look at the 100% Access program in Lane County, you look at some of the primary care home models we have seen in Salem, local involvement in match is very important.
If there were parameters followed, Madam Chair, if there were some kind of standards or parameters put in there, would you be supportive of that? Because I am looking at what they have done in Eugene and what's been done in Salem and other things, and I also believe that when local communities make a commitment, they then support and follow through with the commitment that they've made.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I would not be averse to requiring some sort of a match, and I think we can discuss how it might be allocated. We've also had those conversations with DHS, which have assured us that will be part of the evaluative process.
For the sake of time, what I'd like to do, since I didn't do a good job of management today, and I apologize.
You're pretty good, I think.
What I'd like to do is to open a work session on this bill and then carry over the hearing and the work session until tomorrow. Anything for the good of the order?
Chair, thank you for hearing the bill, and thanks for doing a great job. You covered more in an hour than we've ever done in 3 or 4 hours.
Thank you.